ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Before he was feted or vilified, perhaps, as one of the most influential living philosophers and the godfather of the modern animal rights movement, Peter Singer was just a young Australian grad student sitting down to eat his spaghetti and meat sauce with a fellow student. And that lunchtime conversation must have been pretty powerful because it put him on the path that led to this seminal book, Animal Liberation. It's 50 years since then, and he's just published a new version with big chunks of new material. It's called Animal Liberation Now. He's a professor of bioethics at Princeton University. What hopes does he have now, I wonder, for the future of our planet? Professor Singer, welcome back to Life Matters.
Thank you, Hilary. It's good to be with you.
We've got a bit of time to have a chat today, which is good, I think, because your ideas need a bit of time to stretch. Let's start early on. Your parents were Jewish migrants who fled from Nazi-occupied Austria to Melbourne in 1938. How did their experience shape your relationship to food and ethics, do you think?
Well, as far as food is concerned, I don't think they really influenced me with where I am now, because coming from Austria, that's a pretty heavily meat cuisine. And I would say, you know, we had meat with every dinner and a lot of lunches probably too, not so much for breakfast. But in terms of the overall experience, I think I got a sense of just how bad people can be from the Nazis and what the Nazis did. And that was very close to our family, because although my parents got out in time, their parents did not. And of my four grandparents, only one of them, my mother's mother, survived after being in one of the camps. And she did come out to Australia. So she lived till I was about nine. So I grew up with her. But you know, the absence of the other grandparents and the sadness of my parents about what had happened to their parents was very present in my life. And of course, so the horrors of what the Nazis had inflicted on Europe in general and on Jews and others there, I was very sharply aware of that.
Mm. So fast forward quite a few years to when you're in your 20s, and there's a now famous story of how you went to lunch with a fellow student to continue a discussion from class, and he gave you such powerful arguments against eating meat that it helped set you on this path. What was it about the way he delivered that argument that was so influential to you?
You know, in a way, it wasn't really a lot of an argument. It was more, firstly, saying that simply he didn't think it was right to treat animals in the way that they were treated, to be made into the food that I was then eating, but he wasn't, because he was a vegetarian. Secondly, it was the fact that, you know, he was a vegetarian who seemed a very sensible person with ideas rather similar to me. And, you know, in 1970, you didn't meet many vegetarians. You might meet somebody who was a vegetarian because they were from India, had a Hindu background, but that wasn't something that I would particularly associate with. So the fact that he thought it was wrong to treat animals the way we're treating them, to be turned into meat, made me think about it. And also, I really did not know at that time that a lot of the animals I was eating had not been out grazing in the fields having pleasant lives, but had been crowded into sheds or kept in basically cages in order to be turned into meat, and that factory farming was really just using animals as machines, really, for turning low-priced grain into higher-priced flesh or eggs. I didn't know much about that. I don't think many people did. It hadn't really been publicized. And finding that out made me think about, how should we treat animals? What is the moral status of animals? Something that I'd never really thought about much, which probably is hard to believe for younger people today, but animals were not really an issue on the agenda of most people in the 1960s.
Yeah, we had less excuse for ignorance back then. It sounds interesting, Peter. There's a combination of new information, it chiming with your existing values, what he was saying, and his sense of conviction that were motivators there. But it sounds also like becoming vegetarian at that time was, as you say, you know, pretty rare thing among Western societies. On a practical level, what did it involve? How hard was it?
Well, in a way, the hardest aspect of it was telling people that we were vegetarian, because it was clear that some of them thought we'd become cranks of some kind. You know, this was a weird thing to do. So that was part of it. The other part of it was thinking about how to reconstruct what we're eating. I was already married then, and so my wife also had a European background. So the cuisines that we had grown up with were very heavily meat-centered. And now we had to think about changing that. And thinking what would we could we do instead. We did try using some meat substitutes, basically TVP, textured vegetable protein, was available then.
Oh, yes. But
it was pretty terrible. And yeah, we really didn't stay with that for too long. So then we had to think about, well, you know, there are these other cuisines that don't use meat so much, or sometimes not at all, like Indian cuisine has a lot of vegetarian dishes. So I started making dal and rice, you know, lentil curry and rice, which was new and which I still enjoy and still make. And then more Chinese food, because the meat was more incidental to that. And you could substitute tofu that was available. So, yeah, it helped us to expand our cuisines, really. A lot more Mediterranean, Middle Eastern, rather than the meat-heavy Central European dishes that we've been eating.
Yes, the contrast to your parents' diet must have been extreme at that point. And I noticed, Peter, that you reinstated some recipes in the back of this edition. They kind of lapsed from some of the previous editions. Why was that decision made?
Well, they were in the first edition because, you know, I was recommending that people stop eating meat. And I thought that, you know, like me, they won't know what to eat. There weren't really many good vegetarian, let alone vegan, cookbooks at that time. So I put in some recipes. And then by the time the second edition came around in 1990, there were a lot of vegetarian and vegan cooking, you know, cookbooks. There'd been a bit of a boom in that field. And so I thought, well, they're no longer needed. But then when I took them out, a lot of people said, oh, I liked it, that, you know, this was a philosophy book that had recipes in it. That was nice. So basically, I put them back in because people seemed to respond positively to them. But I did it rather differently this time. Instead of just, you know, showing people what you could eat, the kinds of things that now you could easily find in cookbooks, I made it more personal. And I started off with the dishes that survived from my parents' and my wife's parents' cuisines that were vegetarian or could be made vegetarian or vegan. And then I put in some of our other favorites, like the dal that I just mentioned, stir fries, which I do quite a lot, vary a bit. My wife's borscht, she has a Polish background, so borscht is one of her favorites that we still have. It's a more personal account now of what we like to eat and cook.
We're speaking with Peter Singer, who is a very well-known thinker and writer and speaker. He's a professor of bioethics at Princeton University. Peter, the book, you know, a couple of years after that very powerful conversation came out, Animal Liberation, was seen as the Bible of this quite rapidly growing movement. And activists apparently who broke into labs to take animals out would leave a copy of the book behind to show their ethical basis for their actions. What was it like for you to experience that response at the time?
Well, that was very exciting, I have to say, to see the new movement starting to grow. And some of it, as you say, did grow quite fast. For example, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals was started, and they had a policy that anybody who joined or donated to them, they would send a copy of the paperback edition of Animal Liberation. And they got through hundreds of thousands of copies, literally, by doing that. They had big bulk orders. In fact, there was an edition that had printed on the front cover with the compliments of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. They were giving away so many. So the book was getting around. The movement was active and growing. It was getting quite a lot of media attention. And at that stage, it seemed really hopeful that it could bring about quite significant changes in a fairly short time.
Well, and how are you feeling about that now? Because I was reading how the text hadn't been updated since about 1990, and you'd been getting research assistants to pull out papers on animal experimentation now to contrast what was happening. How much has changed?
Well, some things have changed, but at the same time, it was disappointing in the sense that the pace of change slackened after some initial progress. Things really slowed down, and it does depend quite a lot what country you're looking at. There was more progress in Europe. In fact, in the entire European Union, there was progress with prohibitions on some of the worst forms of confinement of farmed animals that I described in the earlier editions. So, for example, the standard cages for egg-laying hens that are still permitted in Australia, small wire cages where the hens can't really stretch their wings sufficiently. So they have been prohibited since about, I think, 2011 or 2012 in the European Union. The Australian government has now said they'll phase them out by 2036. So it's a long time behind Europe. And in the United States, they're also still, the majority of egg-laying hens are still in those standard wire cages. So, yeah, progress in Europe on that, and not in the United States and less in Australia. And that's true with the way pigs are kept, the confinement, kind of close confinement for pigs, and to some extent for veal calves, although veal calves, the producers got such bad publicity that they were more or less forced to stop having the calves in individual, very narrow stalls that they couldn't turn around in, and where they were deliberately made anemic to make the flesh a more pale pink color, which fetched a higher price. So, yeah, some progress, but not really as much as I would have hoped for, because still factory farming is still pretty standard. Huge numbers of animals are indoors. Pretty much all the chicken that is produced, chicken meat, is produced from animals crowded indoors, never going outside, and bred to grow extremely fast in ways that actually causes them pain, because they put on weight so fast their immature leg bones can't really support the weight properly. So there's a lot more that needs to be done, unfortunately, and that at the moment isn't really being done.
So, Peter, veganism took off in recent years. I mean, there are lots of restaurants, at least in the major cities. It seems quite normalised. The supermarket freezers are full of quite highly processed vegan foods. Would you see that as progress as well?
Oh, I certainly do see that as progress, yes. It's a different kind of progress. It's not clear to what extent the number of people who are committed vegans has increased. I mean, it certainly has increased. Maybe it's doubled, but it's doubled from quite a low base. But it seems that a lot of other people are eating less meat, and they're eating plant-based foods maybe two or three times a week. And that's, I think, supporting the products that you mentioned that are in supermarkets. And that's definitely a good thing, because if we can get more people to do that, there will be less demand for factory-farmed animal products. And hopefully then the number of animals suffering in this way will be reduced.
Some really interesting texts coming in, Peter, on the pace of change or otherwise. One says, becoming vegetarian in 1990 as a 13-year-old, there were still comments that I was overreacting and being a bit silly. I love the comment, this texter says, from KD Lang, that her family were fine with her lesbianism but horrified at her vegetarianism. Others saying that Peter Singer changed my life 50 years ago when I read Animal Liberation. I haven't eaten red meat for 50-plus years and I live a healthy, happy life. When I read Peter's account of their family rabbit, it really resonated. That's from another Peter. I too became veg in the early 70s and was accused of self-mutilation because I was depriving my body of necessary nutrients. And one person saying, who was the dude who changed Professor Singer's mind? Was it Richard Keshen, Peter?
Yes, that's correct. Richard Keshen, who was a Canadian. This lunch was in Oxford, where we were both graduate students. Richard had come from Canada. And, you know, we're still in contact. We do manage to see each other occasionally. We go to Canada and see them. The last time I think we saw them, they have come here, and I'm hoping they'll, Richard and his wife Mary will come again. So although it's 50 years on, actually 53 from that lunch, we're all four of us, my wife as well, is still going well, and so it's great to be in touch. And I think Richard is aware of the role that he played, and is proud of having done so.
Yep, he's repeatedly cited, which is great. Peter, one of your the central tenets of your thought is the idea of speciesism, the human-held belief that all other animal species are inferior and even a means to human ends. And I guess a part of that relates to their ability to feel sensations, feel pain, be sentient. What do we know for certain now about the way animals experience pain, and how much has that changed since you first wrote the book?
I think, you know, 50 years ago we went in much doubt that birds and mammals feel pain. I think that was pretty generally, not quite universally agreed. There were some skeptics and some doubters, and in fact there was a practice in psychology, in academic research psychology, not to refer to animals as being pain. It was thought to be unscientific because you can't observe the pain. So in describing, let's say, an experiment in which you gave a dog an electric shock, you wouldn't say the dog showed a painful response. You would say the dog showed an aversive response. That meant the dog moved away from the whatever it was that was giving them an electric shock.
which is something that you could scientifically observe, but to impute that the dog was suffering pain was supposed to be unscientific. And I think that might have contributed to rather more heartless experiments going on in psych laboratories. But I don't think the general public actually believe that for a moment. They certainly weren't going to believe that dogs don't feel pain. And by extension, that would apply to all of the as I say, the birds and mammals. But if you come to fish, who are, of course, also vertebrates and have a centrally organized nervous system with a brain, there was definitely more skepticism, perhaps because they can't vocalize, we can't read expressions on their faces. So there was some doubts about that. And now there's been really good research, I think, showing without any real doubt that fish do feel pain, that they even trade off pain against things that they want. So, if they're hungry and there's food, but they have to pass through something that inflicts an electric shock on them as they pass through it, they will still do that if the shock is not too strong and depending on how hungry they are. So they're trading off their need for food against the shock or even their desire to be with a companion if it's a species where they seek a companion. So I think there's no doubt really about fish now. And we're starting to look at invertebrates more positively. Again, there was that documentary about the octopus, which I think convinced quite a lot of people who saw it that an octopus does have feelings and can actually relate to a human being even, but also the behavior of the octopus, which you can find lots of amusing examples of on YouTube, I think clearly shows that they're intelligent problem solvers, and it's pretty difficult to believe they don't feel pain. And now some of the research is moving on to crustaceans. I think the British Parliament recently amended their list of beings who are categorized as sentient beings, that is, having a different moral status from just things. And they included a group of crustaceans that includes lobsters and crabs.
Mm.
So I think we're now pretty clear that when you throw a lobster or crab into a pot of boiling water, they are feeling it. They're suffering pain for the time they take to die.
A lot of people texting in with some of the choices that they've made as we're speaking with Peter Singer here on Life Matters today. I guess some of the degrees that they choose to go on the path to vegetarianism or veganism, and some of that's about the constraints on their lives. James in Newport in New South Wales says, I was vegetarian 53 years ago, but being a manual worker in Manchester, England, I found it too hard to sustain for many of the reasons explained by Peter. In the end, I was undone by the conundrum of eating eggs and the surreptitious inclusion of animal fats in so many foods available on a budget at that time. Where does Peter sit on eggs, he says? And also, I guess, part of that question, Peter, is where do you sit on the constraints of people's lives and how much they're able to afford fresh fruit and veg as opposed to process things involving meat?
Right. Well, obviously, the difficulty of having a diet without meat or without animal products is relevant to what people must choose. And the person I have in mind when I'm writing this is somebody who has access to a supermarket where they can obtain plant products and a healthy, nutritious diet without meat or sometimes without any animal products. And a lot of people do now have access to that. Some of those special plant-based meat-like products in the supermarket cabinets are more expensive. And I understand that not everyone can afford that. But the dish that I mentioned that's one of my favourites, the dal, is really a very inexpensive dish if you buy your lentils dried rather than coming out of a can, which I think they're better anyway that way. That's a very inexpensive way of getting your protein. So it often can be done, but I can certainly understand people who have difficulties. The person who wrote in and said that they felt they needed something maybe that was more of an animal protein and they went for eggs. I think it's really important here to think about how the hens who laid those eggs were treated. And if you're just buying the cheapest eggs, then you will be getting them from caged hens, certainly in Australia. If that person was in Manchester, England, then that was the same rules as the European Union, which the UK has kept despite leaving the Union. So they wouldn't have been the small wire cages, but they could still have been in larger cages. I'd say if you do want to eat eggs, then look for genuinely free-range eggs from hens that are who are ranging around, able to go outside. I've noticed that in Australia, some of the egg cartons actually tell you how many hens they stock per hectare. So if they're something like 1,500 or fewer, I think they've got plenty of space. And that's, you know, that's a compromise that people might make. I'm not saying that their lives are ideal, but it's certainly a much better way of getting animal protein than just, you know, buying meat or chicken where you when you don't know where it's come from and it probably has come from a factory farm or a feedlot.
And Peter, often I guess with vegetarianism, people say, well, look, how far down the food chain do we go with this idea? Insects, you know, a bacterial life, does it complicate farming of vegetables, for example, if we don't kill insect pests?
Yes, it's true. And this is something I said against the idea of not eating animals. I said, well, you're going to be responsible for killing something anyway, because, you know, you do have to spray the crops and that is going to kill some insects. I think we have to be realistic here. We can minimize the harm we do. We may not be able to completely avoid it, even if you grow vegetables in your back garden, and I've certainly done that. You're going to have to do something about the snails or slugs, or if you're growing the brassicas, the cabbage or the kale, then there's those little green caterpillars that get on it. So you can't be absolutely pure. But it's, you know, we don't really know whether the insects and the slugs do feel pain. They may. So I certainly think that if you are going to kill them, try and kill them quickly. But I don't think it's wrong to kill them in order to protect your food supply. I think you have to make those sorts of compromises. So how far down the food chain you would go? Yeah, well, I would say, as I said, certainly all vertebrates, and then the octopus and the lobster and so on. But if you, say, wanted to eat oysters or mussels, I think it's unlikely that they can feel pain. They have much more rudimentary nervous systems. And if we assume that animals who evolved pain did so in order to be able to move away from a source of danger, a threat, and that's why pain was useful in evolutionary terms, helped them to survive, then that's not really going to apply to an oyster, because an oyster can't really move away from the source of danger. So, yeah, I think, you know, that's where I draw the line. I say, somewhere between a shrimp and an oyster. I prefer not to eat a shrimp. It's mobile and might well be able to feel pain, whereas an oyster, I think, it's very unlikely that it does.
There's a lot to think about. Peter, would you keep a pet?
Yes, we did when the kids were small. One of your listeners said something about the family rabbit, but we didn't have a rabbit. What we had were ex-laboratory rats, and I have mentioned them occasionally, so I think that's probably what the person was thinking of. I would not want to really have a cat. We did adopt a stray cat for a while, but it's very hard to avoid feeding cats on meat or fish anyway. And yeah, you know, you can say, well, they don't really have a choice, so certainly they're not morally at fault. But if we have a choice of having a different companion animal who is not obliged to eat fish or meat, then perhaps that's a better way to go. But
well,
you know, I'm not going to be hard on people who do have cats or dogs and feed them meat. I think it's good to look for alternatives if they exist, and there are some alternatives, particularly for dogs. So you could try that. But, you know, again, you have to make compromises, and some people are very fond of living with a dog or a cat, and I wouldn't be too hard on them for that.
Yeah, I think that sense of judgment is something a lot of people worry about when we start to talk about vegetarianism and veganism. I'm sensing that emerging in the text messages, but also a lot of people saying, you know, responding to you, Peter, and saying, thank you. I went vegetarian in the early 80s at 13. I now run a large farmed animal sanctuary near Byron Bay, so that was life-changing. I've been vegetarian for decades and am now vegan. It took me that long to realise eating eggs and dairy involved animal suffering. And Dean from Templestowe in Melbourne says, I started Australia's first vegan organic mobile food truck, before they were called food trucks, in 1996. We travelled the country catering at festivals, bush doofs and markets. And he thanks Peter for helping guide him in this conscious choice as well. Peter, another text though saying, look, you know, if you're flying around the country twice a year or however often it is, contributing to climate change, should you really be talking about the impact of meat on climate change? Can we pick and choose, Peter, eat meat or fly?
Well, it's certainly better to do neither, I think, or to minimise your flying anyway. And it's true that I do fly. Obviously, I'm here at Princeton teaching, and I have children and grandchildren in Melbourne, so I'm not going to give up spending time with them. And so I've moved to being half-time at Princeton, so I can spend more time in Melbourne. Yes, there's definitely greenhouse gas emissions because of that flying. You can buy offsets for them, but it's not quite the same, I know. But on the other hand, I think if I were not at Princeton, I would be less effective in terms of trying to spread the ideas that I'm spreading, both to my students, but also it's just a fact that being at a well-known university like Princeton means that people pay more attention to what you say. You know, it's like giving you a bit of a megaphone. So I think it's worth it for that reason. But yeah, I don't claim to be perfect. I'd like to keep my carbon footprint as low as possible. And avoiding meat is certainly one important way of doing that. But trying to reduce your fossil fuel emissions through transport is another important thing to do.
I think it will be a relief to a lot of people to hear that you're not perfect and we don't have to be perfect, but that the choices we make can have impacts. Peter, just on the Australian farming situation, I know there's been changes in recent years, the so-called ag gag laws to prevent activists filming farmed animals suffering. What kind of regulation would you like to see around the transparency of farming practices here?
Well, I'd like to see exactly the reverse of those ag gag laws. Paul McCartney is often quoted as having said, if slaughterhouses had glass walls, we'd all be vegetarians. And I would like to see more transparency. You don't have to have glass walls, which presumably would become blood spattered after a while. But there's no reason why you can't have video cameras in slaughterhouses and even in factory farms, really, that would show people what was going on. And I think there's a case to be made that in the interest of transparency and of people making informed choices about what they're buying, it would be a good thing to require those video cameras connected to through the internet to a site that everybody had access to, so that the public would know how the animals they're eating lived and died. I think that would have a positive effect and would lead to a more better informed society.
Peter, so many text messages, I can't keep up with them, but I'll read our listeners a couple just to illustrate some of the points you've been talking about. Judy in Castlemaine says, I was put off studying psychology by their nightmare-inducing experiments involving torturing newborn monkeys to prove that, says Judy, mothers are important. This issue raised by one texter, life is disruption. One of the slightly petty things that annoys me about the vegan movement is the use of PU, in quotes, leather. This is plastic. The disruption and destruction caused by plastics in the environment is huge, all for not buying meat from feedlots, etc., and thinking about the way all of our food is produced. So a plea for kind of perspective there. Peter, just to finish up with, how optimistic are you about the future of reducing meat consumption, given that it's risen substantially around the world since you first published Animal Liberation?
Yes, it's risen on a global scale, largely because of China's increasing prosperity and the fact that people in China use their extra income to buy more meat. So that's a real problem, because they've also gone in for a huge amount of intensive factory farm development. In Western countries, it's not rising that much. And in some countries, in Germany, for example, it's actually falling. Partly through concern for animals and partly through concern for the climate. So I'm hopeful that it will tail off in Western countries fairly soon and start to decline with the greater availability of plant-based products. And, you know, I'm not sure what will happen in China. I certainly hope that there will be a reaction there. My book, Animal Liberation, in the early edition, does exist in Chinese translation, and I hope the new one will soon too. I'm hoping to be able to go to China next year to try to talk to people about this and raise awareness of the issues. So I think eventually we will start to see declining meat consumption. And I think we do make progress in ethics slowly when you look back over decades and centuries. And I think we will expand the circle of our concern to include animals at some stage, but it's, you know, it's hard to predict when, and I'm certainly not going to live to see the day when we're not eating meat at all, but I do hope that it will come.
Peter, always interesting to chat to you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Hilary. It's been great chatting to you and hearing the comments from your listeners too.
Very engaged audience here at Life Matters. Thank you. Peter Singer is a professor of bioethics at Princeton University, and he's just put out an updated version of his best-selling book, Animal Liberation. It's called Animal Liberation Now.
It's easier than ever to hear your favourite local and national ABC radio stations, live and on demand on the ABC Listen app.